This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, hello again, everybody at TFMR. It is that time of the week where once again we have your Thursday conversation. And once again, by virtue of my messed up calendar, we're recording this on Tuesday. And you're probably listening to it on Wednesday, the way this week is shaping up. But anyway, it is your weekly, or try to make it weekly, podcast where we bring in someone, let you hear from an outside voice as to what they think is going on. And it is a pleasure to bring back today Jim Kunstler. James R. Kunstler is an author and a blogger. He's written over 20 books, and you can find his daily posts at Kunstler. What's that, Jim?
Monday and Friday.
See, I don't even. And what's today? See, I don't know if I'm coming or going, my friend. All right. So anyway, you can Clusterfuck Nation is what you call that, Jim. Tell everybody. I'll just let you talk about it for a second.
Well, it's a blog that I started 20 years ago, and it's evolved, and it has taken a certain form. And I like to think of it as, you know, writing chamber music at 5 o'clock in the morning twice a week. And I'm trying to bring a degree of literary artistry into political and economic commentary, because it's very important that you have to engage people's minds and charm them a little bit to get them to read what you're saying.
Let me ask you this question. 20 books. I can't even, my wife's been begging me to write one for about the last 10 years. Yeah. And I just don't, my ADHD prohibits it. But of your 20, just off the top of your head, where we are in this year of our Lord 2024, you got one or two that if people said, I'm going to go buy one of Jim's books and read it, one or two that are probably most relevant to this current moment in time?
Well, I think probably my most popular book was called The Long Emergency, and it described the period of disorder that we were going to enter in the early 20th century. I published it in 2005. So that was quite a while ago now. It's almost 20 years. But, you know, I was describing the financial picture, the oil picture, the government propaganda picture, the disease potential for engineering viruses that would destabilize politics, which is exactly what's happened. Yep. And so that one's pretty good. And a sequel to it called Too Much Magic. And the subtitle was Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. Because I think what happened after the great financial crash of 28 and 9, I think we entered a period of extreme delusional wishful thinking. And a lot of this, obviously, kind of coalesced around the idea that we would create this green economy of alt energy, and that we would run all of our stuff by other means than fossil fuels. This has turned out to be one of the great delusions of modern history. And unfortunately, the authorities out there continue to use this as a way to apparently just gain more control over Americans, people, you know, in people in Western civ generally, and especially their money and their ability to thrive.
You know, you mentioned delusions in modern history. First thing I thought of when you said that was this thing that's promoted by that Kelton woman, this modern monetary theory.
Yes.
You know,
Stephanie Kelton.
Yeah. You know, that we can just print ourselves into prosperity, you know.
I think we're seeing a demonstration of that right now in real time. And it don't look like it's working out too well, do it?
Well, in the I'm afraid that too many people in the short term think it is.
Well, in the sense that we seem to be keeping a bunch of things running by printing money. But, you know, in the background, we're seeing a really impressive amount of systems failure on the ground. And, you know, by that, I mean things shutting down and ceasing to operate the way they were designed to. You know, I just got a phone call from a guy 5 minutes before we got on the air. This guy is a commercial farmer in, you know, in New England, which is rare because this is not the greatest agricultural region in America. But yeah. He does all right. You know, he lives off of the stuff that he produces for the farmers' markets. Anyway, he keeps his finger on the pulse of what's going on. And he told me today that 11 of the biggest almond farm producers in California are shutting down now because of Gavin Newsom's water policies and making it unable for them to continue operating. And, you know, that kind of thing is a big deal. And so we're seeing a lot of failures in these, that's obviously the ag system. And the ag system is deeply vulnerable because their two biggest inputs to make their things work are fossil fuel based products, you know, fertilizers, herbicides, etc., and capital. And both of those things are kind of in danger of not being as easily available as they were before. In fact, I would say that one of the biggest problems facing us right now, vis-a-vis or apropos of modern monetary theory, is the disappearance of capital. You know, you can continue to create what you call capital or liquidity or money, whatever term of art you want to choose. But what happens is that reality has plans of its own. And so you churn out all this stuff that you call money and or capital. And reality says, well, OK, except that it's not real. You know, it's pretend money. It's pretend capital. And we've got all of these things that represent capital out there that or affect to represent capital that are going to be unmasked and revealed to be worth nothing. And, you know, personally, my personal theory about this is as follows, that the industrial adventure that we've been on and the technology part of it, especially in the late 20th, early 21st century, is something that the human race never went through before. It's lasted about 250 years. And a module of that adventure is the financial module, which has, accompanied it and is an emergent phenomenon in the sense that it is self-organizing as we go along. As we go forward in time, the industrial economy and society becomes ever more elaborate and complex, and so does its module of the financial system. And, you know, we have very cleverly used these evolving financial mechanisms and instruments to, you know, make a living, do trading, to use them to manipulate capital in the way that capital can be manipulated through debt and lending and interest and the fundamental operations of money. But the problem is that it has now reached a level of complexity that we have created too much complexity, and that complexity is all failing. And when you make overinvestments in complexity and the refinements of their operations, you start to disable the whole system. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening out there. 'Cause there are just too many mechanisms that we've created so cleverly in this giant machine that we've built, the finance machine, the global finance machine, that it's become too complex, and its parts are breaking. And you know, you can see it happening in real time, and it expresses itself finally on the ground in the daily lives of people who can't make a living, who don't have enough money to cover their expenses, pay their debts, acquire the things they need to live in this society. And more and more of them are basically getting thrown under the bus.
Yeah.
And, you know, it remains to be seen where the critical threshold is, where you go from going broke suddenly to, you know, everything happening at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as expressed in that old aphorism out of the Hemingway novel,
right,
where the guy said, "How did you go broke?" And he said, "Suddenly, then all at once."
Yeah. You know, there are so many parallels to periods, I guess, in the past. So, of course, this is unique because, as you said, I mean, we have quadrillions worth of derivatives and.
Yeah, all sorts of janky things that we've never seen before.
Yeah.
That seem to work. And, you know, the important word is seem.
But societally, you know, people don't change, right? I mean, we're really no smarter than people 100 years ago or 500 years ago. We just kind of
we might be actually quite a bit
Yeah,
dumber.
That's true, too. Yeah, we just kind of stand on their shoulders of accumulated, you know, knowledge, make us think that we're smarter. You know, and Jim, have you spent much time with that book, When Money Dies, the one by Adam Ferguson?
Yeah, I read it years ago, but I can't say that I remember it that clearly. I read it like 25 years ago.
What's most fascinating, obviously, you know, we talk about the, you know, the inflationary component, you know, and the reparations, the war reparations that were forced upon the German Empire when they lost the war, and then, you know, the Weimar Republic and the wheelbarrows full of cash and all that kind of stuff. But societally, so much is similar, you know, where people are at each other's throats, you know, and that the worst people are the ones that seem to be pushed forward as leaders and stuff like that. And I just,
There's another parallel for that is that the, you know, if you look back on the Weimar Republic of the 1920s, even educated people, even people who, you know, were history majors, couldn't tell you who the leaders of the Weimar Republic were. They were such you know, nothing burger people. So nobody remembers them. And we're in a similar situation today where, you know, we're being ruled by non-entities.
Yeah, right. And that, again, that into that void, you don't know what is going to step in. To me, even I feel like I take it for granted, right, Jim? It's like, well, tomorrow's always going to be just like yesterday. And that's probably not the right way to look at it.
10 years ago, when I was back on the lecture circuit, and I was talking about, I was really on two tracks. I'd started out talking about the fiasco of suburbia. I had written a book about the fiasco of suburban development in America and what a tremendous error it was. And then in the process of writing several books about that and about urban design, you know, I got kind of caught up in the oil story. And that led me to write The Long Emergency in 10 years later. But I was on the lecture circuit talking about how we arrange ourselves in the landscape and, you know, why it's a living arrangement that just has no future. And I used to tell people that this is like 15, 20 years ago, that we're going to get to a point in this country where the public will beg for somebody to push them around and tell them what to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think we're kind of at that point now.
Yeah, that's kind of human nature that doesn't change.
Well, especially if you're floundering and you see your society floundering and you see your society subscribing to a whole roster of ideas that are obviously insane.
You're right.
You know, it makes you feel very helpless. And you see the type of leadership we have that is absolutely unable or unwilling to cope with obvious problems that are not really that hard to shut down. How hard would it be to shut down the Mexican border with the U.S. if we really had the will to do it?
Right.
You know, you could do it in 36 hours, you know, you but could just...
Instead, they tell you that it's not even a problem. What are you talking about? There's not. Like,
first they tell you it's not even a problem. Then you know, Joe Biden tells you that it's a problem that's too complex to fix without additional legislation. It's all bullshit, of course.
Right. So let me ask you this, because I'm more of a kind of chaos person, and I think people inherently, you know, are just either not too smart or they just, you know, I don't like to think things are all connected. Like there's some big plan, you know, by people, you know, with green eye shades or sitting around a campfire somewhere scheming to screw us all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard not to look at the current situation. Like you mentioned the immigration thing. Mm-hmm. It's so against common sense that anybody can see it, but you're told, no, that's not a problem. Or you look at what they're, you know, the war in Russia, you know, or in Ukraine, like, you know, wouldn't you think it would be good to talk about pursuing, you know, some peace talks or something? No, we can't do that. You know, there are so many things that fly kind of counterintuitive to the common sense of the normal person that you start thinking that there's some mass, you know, behind the scenes thing going on.
Well, you do. But, you know, my approach to it would be to just treat it as what you see is what you get. And what we're seeing, you know, are the characters who are behind it, are they're out there and they're visible. You know, they range from a president who seems to be a corrupt tool to his appointed officials like Alejandro Mayorkas, who's a liar and appears to have largely engineered this whole border crisis. And it, you know, it runs to characters like Mark Elias, the lawfare lawyer for the formerly for the DNC, and Norm Eisen, one of his partners in crime, and you know, a whole bunch of those guys who engineered all of the ballot fuckery that went on in the 2020 election. And, you know, these are villains who are plainly out there doing their thing. In fact, Mark Elias or Norm Eisen, one of them, I forget which one, was on Twitter just last night bragging about how, you know, they're going to engineer the 2024 election. And, you know, they're telling you what they're doing. You know, one problem is that there haven't been any consequences for any of their crimes. And so they feel this kind of impunity, and they put themselves in a pretty dangerous position. But, you know, that's where things stand for now. I think a lot of these guys are going to hang.
Well, certainly history is full of examples of that sort of thing working out.
Sure.
You know, our own American Robespierre could be out there someplace.
Yeah, and speaking of Robespierre, you know, I'm a great fan of studying the French Revolution in relation to what we're going through now, especially the Jacobin phase of it.
Yeah.
French Revolution was a very, very complex, drawn-out affair, and I don't think most Americans really, you know, have a clue about how it went, you know, what the scenario was. But about two-thirds of the way through it, it started in 1789, and in 1793, the Jacobin faction, which was essentially the same as the extreme left in America today, they got control of the government through the National Assembly, which was their provisional legislature, and they formed this committee called the Committee of Public Safety, you know, which was actually the committee that sent between 20 and 40,000 people to the guillotine. And they also had this program for turning French daily life upside down. They did weird things, like they changed the week from a 7-day week to a 10-day week. They added another month to the calendar. They abolished the Catholic Church, which, whether you like it or not, a lot of people were invested in one way or another, psychologically, in France in the 18th century. And in short, they disordered daily life pretty badly. Mm-hmm. They also caused an inflation to occur by printing paper money called assignats. So they did pretty much the same thing that the American left has been doing for the last 10 years here. And the effect in America, of course, has been to very badly disorder American life and turn Americans against each other. And now the catch is that the Jacobins were overthrown in one night in, I guess, July of 1794. They only ran for a little less than a year in power. And when they were overthrown, you know, Robespierre got up to the rostrum in the National Assembly, or what they had, I think they had changed the name of it at that point. But he got up to the rostrum as usual. And instead of people listening to him, they started throwing food at him, you know. And before long, there was pandemonium in the chamber. And they chased the Jacobins out, and their leadership hid out in the city hall of Paris, the Hotel de Ville. And they eventually caught up with them, and they took them out and cut off their heads the next day, and they were never heard of again.
You have to worry about them anymore.
Their program was abolished like literally overnight. All that bullshit was over overnight, and it didn't really rear its head again until the Bolsheviks showed up in 1917 and, you know, laid their trip on Russia, vulnerable as it was to the kind of trip that got laid on it. And then, you know, it reemerged with Mao Zedong in 1966 with the Cultural Revolution in China, and with Pol Pot in the 1970s in Cambodia. And, you know, periodically, this leftist insanity rears its head, and we're going through it in the United States. It's very hard for people to fathom. Because the things that it's pushing are so crazy.
Thank you for bringing all of this up. I've taken the magazine National Review for probably 30 years back when William Buckley was alive, and so I've read articles on the Jacobins before. It hasn't come up in any of these Thursday conversations. So I want to encourage everybody. Thank you, Jim, for that brief history, and you did a fabulous job. People listening, please look into that. Again, when you look around, you go, this is crazy. Like, you know, changing the calendar? What? You're putting a overweight tranny in charge of public health? What?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? I mean, it leaves you scratching your head. Yeah. And so those parallels are worth studying, no doubt about it. Jim, I want to, you're being very generous with your time, but I want to, in a kind of one other topic I wanted to make sure I address with you. And this is more, again, economic history, and it relates back to World War I in a sense. I just want to get your thoughts. I've been observing now for a couple of months, and now it's beginning to ramp up, these trial balloons being floated that the US and the EU should seize and steal all of the foreign currency reserves of Russia that are held outside Russia's borders. Again, this was, to memory, I always call it the biggest development of 2022 was when 2 weeks into the war, the U.S. froze Russia out of SWIFT and then also froze about $300-400 billion worth of their foreign currency reserves that were held outside of Russia. Now the idea that's been floated and now is coming from Yellen and Biden too, is that we should just take that money and give it to Ukraine. Now, that happens at the end of the war when you lose the war sometimes, like Germany. Doesn't usually happen mid-war.
Especially when the other side is winning.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts? I mean, a big picture, you know, smaller picture. What are your thoughts on this idea? And what would be the consequences if this actually comes to pass?
I think it's pretty clear. It's plumb crazy. And the main consequence would be it would be regarded by the whole rest of the world as a default on American debt obligations. And it would probably kill the bond market in America and set off a chain of financial events that would absolutely disorder our daily life in America.
But it would feel good, right? Isn't that what?
Nah, it's
No,
just.
not to you and I, but to the politicians in power.
Well, there are all kinds of lunatic actions that might feel good to a lunatic, but it doesn't mean that it would feel good to anybody else. I mean, look, this whole campaign against Russia that for going on for like 8 or 10 years now to demonize them is absolutely idiotic. When Russia managed to get out from under the Soviet system, and that is now more than 30 years ago. And we went over there and we did some asset stripping and created additional problems for them making a transition back to normality. When they finally did arrive at a place where they had a decent operating society with allowing for private business and shopping and all the normal operations of capitalism. I think the Russians wanted nothing more than to be treated as a normal European nation once again. And we refused to do that.
Right.
And in all the years since, we have refused to treat them like a normal European nation. And that's what they are now and have been for quite a while. And our refusal to do it has to do with some kind of a psychopathic theme that's running through the State Department and the intelligence community, and perhaps what we call the military industrial complex of arms makers and people who profit off of conflict and war and weaponry. But it's this demonization of Russia has been completely crazy. It continues. Now, the good news is that just today, Victoria Nuland, one of the chief architects of all this, announced her resignation from being a deputy secretary of state. And she's not going to be on the scene any longer. I'm not sure what kind of pressures she's under, but my guess is it had something to do with the failure of their Ukraine project, because the thing is failing. And Russia, we started the Ukraine war, and Russia's going to end it for us. I don't think that they're going to end it in any way that would be necessarily bad for the USA. I mean, the whole thing was completely unnecessary. Ukraine didn't bother anybody for the last, since the end of the Second World War, even when it, during the time that it was a Soviet republic, and then afterwards, the time when it was a sovereign nation. It wasn't anybody's problem until we made it a problem. And I think it's the ambition of Russia to turn it back into a place that's not a problem for them or anybody else in the world. And we won't allow that to happen. And it's important for us for some reason to continue to make it a problem. But they're going to solve that problem for us. And the big question is whether the humiliation of them having accomplished that is going to be so deep that it provokes the West to do something crazy.
Right.
And we're seeing a lot of craziness out there. The Germans were revealed. They were secretly recorded. The generals in Germany were secretly recorded planning an attack on the Kerch Bridge just last week. And that was a big embarrassment to them. And, the Europeans are pretending that they're going to contribute more weapons and money to the Ukraine project, but they don't have it. They don't have the scratch. They don't have the mojo. They're deindustrializing. And we're helping them deindustrialize. We're helping them go medieval. So the whole thing is absolutely preposterous and insane. And the really unfortunate thing is that the thinking class in America has lost its mind and lost its shit, and they go along with all that insanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's left to the people from the normal, you know, working stiff classes, you know, at least the ones that are left, to try to oppose that. And, you know, living in insane times is pretty tough. The one thing I'd leave your listeners with is the probability that we're going to get through this. This kind of thing doesn't last forever. It can go on for a long time and be very annoying and damaging, but it doesn't go on forever. And this is going to stop. I think that we're getting to the point now where, you know, we're exiting this phase of our history.
Where we get to the point where we are the ones that stand up and start throwing the vegetables.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to start throwing the vegetables at the left, and over. I think they're in the process of doing being exposed, you know, for being the lunatics that they are.
I worry about the caged animal idea, though, you know, that they just lash out and double down and make it worse and worse before it gets any better.
Well, that's one of the appearances of things, perhaps, but I don't think that they're really potent, capable animals.
Yeah, I think
that they're sick and they're wounded and they're senseless and they can't look, considering the insanity of their actions, just imagine the disorder of their thoughts.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And really their support is much more thin than they might believe.
Really, what it only amounts to is the news media. And right. and one of the great mysteries of our time will be, why the hell did the newspaper, did the media, the newspapers and cable stations go along with this insanity?
Yeah.
What was really in it for them? And, you know, the only really the only answer that makes any sense at all is that they have been essentially taken over by the intelligence services.
And their fellow travelers too, Jim, right? Their fellow Jacobins in a way.
Well, yeah, I suppose there's some of that, but they can't all be that crazy.
No, you're right. I'm sure you've seen that Benz, that Mike Benz.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I referenced that. I'm sure most people listening to us have seen that. I've featured it pretty prominently here on the site about what he
Yeah, he has revealed the whole scaffold of the interagency mindfuck business.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Let's get those vegetables. Hopefully I have a good growing season, Jim. And we'll
get some big old rotten tomatoes.
All right. Tell everybody again where they can find you on a regular basis.
My blog, Clusterfuck Nation, comes out every Monday and every Friday at both www.kunstler.com and on Substack. So just look for it. It's Clusterfuck Nation on Substack. And my books are all on my website. I have a new book out called Young Man Blues, which is kind of a memoir of growing up in the 1960s and 70s. And it's about the, you know, it's aimed really at the younger generation of kids who are having a very hard time getting through adolescence in a very punishing economy and a punishing culture.
Yeah.
So Young Man Blues is new. And I also have a collection of my blogs out called Crazy Land.
I think that's fabulous that you've chosen to write about that, because that is I have two daughters that are 23 and 25, you know, coming of age. They came of age just as social media took off. And man, talk about flying blind as a parent, right?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So those.
But I think boys are having an especially hard time because, you know, they're being dumped on so badly.
Right. And I think that's wonderful. When will that book be available, Jeff?
That's it. They're both out on Amazon right now.
All right.
Crazy Land and Young Man Blues.
I will put the links to your site and your Substack and a couple of those books on this page so people can check it out. And Jim, all I ask is that we keep in touch, my friend. It has sure been a pleasure to get a chance to get to know you. And I value your insights and the information. You know, I'll see you out there being interviewed and hanging out with some of my other friends like Luongo and Dave Collum and those guys. And you guys all do a great job of just kind of opening eyes, getting people to think. So please keep it up.
Yeah, thanks. It's a great posse to be in.
Oh, they're smart guys. I always joke with Dave because I don't, anybody that can figure out organic chemistry is a genius. And then if you can actually teach it to somebody, goodness gracious.
And have room in your brain for other things.
For other stuff, yeah. You're not just like some complete weirdo that just simply draws, you know, little organic molecules, you know, with the bonds and the double bonds. That you can actually contemplate other things in life. Yeah, he's a brilliant guy. But as are you, Jim. So thank you so much for spending some time with me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Craig.
And from all of us at TFMR, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed this week's Thursday conversation. We'll have another one for you next week.